supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, as the new year approaches, it's time for you to make your organic resolutions. We've got some for you to resolve to. We've also got a special little New Year's treat we're going to drop on you. But mostly, it's a fabulous phone call show, cats and kittens. You know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping at 1-888-346-9499. Amy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. I live in Wilmington, and I have a question about compost.
Oh, go ahead. Our favorite topic.
I'm afraid that I've ruined a whole batch. My compost bins are 32-gallon plastic trash cans with tight-fitting lids that I drilled 1/2-inch holes all around the sides and the top and the bottom to let air in. And until the other day, the only thing I had put in there were leaves. And then I put a handful, like maybe 7 or 8 shrimp shells in there and some other kitchen scraps, just in one of the barrels. And because I was afraid of the smell, I put them through a food processor with all the kitchen stuff, and I mixed it in with the leaves really well. And then I read online that shrimp shells are really high in nitrogen and that the smell is likely to attract all sorts of uninvited guests. Have I ruined the whole batch? Do I have to just start over? Should I just not put anything else in there?
I don't think you've done anything terribly wrong.
Oh, good.
Now, are your leaves shredded?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So you have trash cans with holes drilled
in. Yeah, and I put a little chimney in there, like you said, with the
really
the wire thing. Yeah.
So are the tops of the trash cans off?
No, they're on tight, and I drilled holes in them, so there's, you know, air can get in around all sides.
Okay, but the chimney is covered by the lid?
Yes.
Because for the chimney to work, you'd have to cut a hole in the top.
There are lots of holes in the top.
No, I'm just saying should explain to people that when you have a big outdoor pile of leaves or a bin, one way to get air to the center of the pile is to take some chicken wire, wrap it into a tube the size of your arm or leg, and then build the pile around that. But one of the rules of chimneys is that they have to extend over the top of the pile so they can bring air from the world down into the center. But again, even having just a chimney in the center, you're not doing any harm.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sealed compost bin, I will tell you that shrimp shells are exceptional. There is nothing wrong with sources of nitrogen, especially shrimp shells and coffee grounds. Those are two of the, quote, kitchen wastes that are incredibly valuable. Your leaves are essentially all carbon, but they're very lively because they were in the outside world. They've got all these bacteria and different, like, microorganisms teeming over them. So leaves alone will break down into compost. But to make the best compost, you want to add a source of nitrogen. Now, you don't want to have a big open pile somewhere and be adding a lot of shellfish waste to it because, again, as you correctly note, you'll attract mice, rats, raccoons, neighborhood cats. But in a homemade composter, or even a store-bought composter like the sealed units you see for sale or sometimes universities give away at composting classes. That's not an issue because the animals can't get inside. And it sounds like you've used a very small amount. And you ground them up so they're going to be mixing in with the leaves. That's only going to improve your compost.
Oh, okay. So how much more can I put in there? I mean, if it's a 32-gallon trash can.
I'm sorry. I was told there wouldn't be any math today. I'm going to say a quart.
Okay.
How's that? A quart of liquefied shrimp shells or crab shells or even lobster shells. Especially, I like the fact that you're whizzing them up and pouring them in there. There's really no harm to adding regular kitchen waste, except if you add too much of it, it'll slow the composting process down. And unfortunately, most of people's kitchen waste, like apple cores and lettuce leaves, adds no nutrition, doesn't have a lot of nitrogen. The big sources of nitrogen out of the kitchen are your seafood shells and coffee grounds. And if you want to process your kitchen waste, I really urge people to get a worm bin. I was late to worm composting. I've only had mine for about 2 years now, and I don't know how I lived without my wormies, because especially in the middle of winter, who wants to be going out to a composter or a pile, kicking snow off your boots with a little cluster of frozen garbage? So much better to have a worm bin somewhere in the house. Give the garbage to the worms. They turn it into the only plant nutrient that's better than compost.
Oh, okay.
So seafood shells to some degree, don't go nuts. Coffee yep. grounds, you can really go wild. In a regular size composter, you can mix in 5 pounds of wet coffee grounds and get magnificent compost. But for most kitchen waste, that's better processed by worms.
All right. Well, that's great. Well, I'm so relieved to hear. I didn't trash my whole
Instead, you actually did a good thing.
Oh, well, great. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, Amy.
All right. Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Carl, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. I am in Matteny, North Carolina.
Okay.
Up in the mountains in the west.
Oh, very good.
Halfway between Valley Cruces and Banner Elk.
Oh, it's beautiful up there.
It is. But my question is, I have become a bulbhead. I love growing garlic.
Oh, it's the best, isn't it?
It is wonderful. It's the first thing up. We had a warm winter last year. It was up in February. I had a bumper crop. It took 3 wheelbarrow loads to get it out of the garden.
Oh, now you're bragging.
This year, when the garlic came in, I got bulbs that had no, we call them toes in the South, or cloves for anybody else. It was one large bulb that looked like an onion.
Oh, I see.
2.5 inches in diameter.
Okay. So let me just backtrack. Now, are you planting in the winter or the fall?
I'm planting in the fall.
Oh, okay, good. And you're taking heads of garlic, and you're breaking them apart, and you're planting single cloves.
Yes.
When you harvested in, I presume you harvest in June in North Carolina, right?
July.
June
About
or July.
Mid-July, the bottom leaves will start turning brown, and that's when I harvest them.
Very good. And you did get a lot of normal heads of garlic.
Oh, tons.
But you also got these strange heads that you weren't used to.
Yeah. And I talked to a friend of mine who's a commercial organic gardener, and he's seen the same thing, and he calls them cyclops.
Okay, so in other words, instead of a head filled with cloves, you got a papery shell that just had one big hunk of garlic inside it.
Yeah, and it's kind of green looking.
And what was the quality of the garlic? Was it mild? Was it hot?
It was kind of mild.
Okay.
It looks like an onion,
right?
But it tastes like garlic.
Okay, there's two things that could be happening here. Now, are you planting hardneck or softneck garlic?
This was all hardneck. I just this year have started planting softneck.
What is the possibility that when your garlic scape, that is when the little bulges appeared on the top, that you failed to cut them all off?
I cut most all of them off because I was taking them to a local organic restaurant.
What's the key word in what Carl just said?
I might not have got them all off.
So you know what happened? Some of the garlic heads went to seed, and they formed that big seed head, and Carl didn't pay any attention to them. And inside those seed heads were things that look like a kernel of corn. And if Carl doesn't do anything, they drop to the ground. And they remain there in the ground. And then they act like a clove that you have planted. But the interesting thing about these, I think they're called bulbets or something like that, boobles something. Because I've done this deliberately, is when one of those gets planted, it follows the same life cycle as a head of garlic, but instead of making a head, it forms an onion-shaped thing that is a single piece of garlic. And see, this is your next thing that you're going to be playing with in garlic world. You're going to continue to replant these single cloved things. And if you do this year after year, just replanting that one solid little onion-shaped piece of garlic, you eventually wind up with a garlic clove the size and shape of a baseball.
Well, I did replant some of them.
But I think that's what happened. I think some of your garlic went to seed. The seed hit the ground. It grew into those single clove things. And if you do this year after year, you can get this amazing specialty garlic that you peel it once and you get a whole head's worth.
Wow. Well, I'll get these other bulbs and get them planted then.
You're going to have so much fun.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Take care, man.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind those of you with 17 minutes to kill that you can now view the video of my recent TEDx talk, describing in dramatic detail how best to achieve the magical transformation of fall leaves into garden gold, and explaining why some leaf blowers really don't suck. But don't go clicking on the TEDx link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, just yet, because we'll be right back with your New Year's resolutions, more of your fabulous phone calls, and a bit of New Year's fun. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 80 new varieties for the 2013 growing season, including Super Sauce, a 2-pound sauce tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, lots more of your fabulous phone calls. And as promised, your organic New Year's resolutions. And because this is kind of a little special New Year's show, we have a little pre-New Year's celebration for you. We have asked our good friend and musician, Sarah Donner, to come back to the show and sing a New Year's song she has written. Sarah, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
It's lovely to have you here. Now, we first had you on the show when you came to our attention about a song you had written about a piece of moving irrigation equipment you had observed while driving across the Great Plains.
Yes, it was called the Center Pivot Irrigation Song. And basically, when you drive across Kansas, it does strange things to your brain if you're a passenger. And when that's all you see for hours and hours on end, started researching it and thought, oh, let's make a wonderful song about this. So that's what I did. And yeah.
And we were pleased to have you play it here in the studio. Since then, you've gone on to do a sock puppet extravaganza called Going Under that is a very popular YouTube video. And now you have Overrated New Year. Now, in real life, one of your many jobs is you are a cat lady, not the cat lady, but you are a cat lady behind Ask a Cat Lady.
Yeah, I write for the website Catster, and I do a music video blog every week on Thursdays called Ask a Cat Lady, and people basically send in their questions about their kitty cats, and I'm a foster cat lady, so I always have a rotating selection of kittens in my house, and you ask the question, and I write your answer in a song, and then I videotape it, and it's a lot of fun. And yeah, it can be a little crazy sometimes with the animals, but we have a good time.
I really recommend people look you up. They go to Ask a Cat Lady at catster.com. But along with your talented friend, Jay the Bassist, you are going to help us move into a new year, which we all hope will be a better new year, with a song you've written called Overrated New Year.
Yes.
Would you do that for us?
I would love to, yeah. This is a, I don't know, I always felt that my holidays were not spent very wisely because they were usually in Connecticut or New Jersey and everybody else seems to be having a much more exciting time on TV. Christmas colored morning, red bags with silver tags, and we're all glad to be gathered in the same house, sleeping when it's cold outside. Here we are together, glass of red and breaking bread, overfed and feeding the simple conversation. An overrated new year, our promise is put on trial. Oh, come ye faithful, hopeful children. Oh, no one here is blameless. No one else can take this guilt and burden, turn it into kindness that compels us. Someone else could show us how to trust. Darkness that still lingers, your fingers finger for the light. Oh, come ye faithful, hopeful children. Oh, no one here is blameless. No one else can take this guilt and burden, turn it into kindness that sunrise. All alone and still unknown, your phone, it won't be shattering the silence. It's priceless, this perfect peace. And butter on your breakfast can't replace the things you need. Children, no one here is blameless. No one else can take this guilt and burden. can turn it into kindness that compels us. Someone else could show us. Oh, come you faithful, hopeful children. Come you faithful, hopeful children.
Sarah Donner, ladies and gentlemen, D-O-N-N-E-R. New Year may be overrated, but Sarah Donner is not. Thanks to Jay the Bassist for coming in. We're going to put a link to Sarah's video version of Overrated New Year up at our website. She is askacatlady@catster.com. She is an official good friend of You Bet Your Garden. Sarah, thanks so much for coming in today and adding to our New Year's joy.
Thank you very much for having me, and I hope you have a happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everyone. And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Mike, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, sir. Where are you?
I'm calling from Wayne, Pennsylvania, just outside of Valley Forge.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Mike near a scenic historic site in Pennsylvania?
Well, I have a question about my azaleas. We've been in our house about 20 years, and when we first moved, we had beautiful azaleas all around the outside of the house. Unfortunately, with kids and work, I just never got a chance to really take good care of them, and they've gotten kind of run down over the last couple of years. They're a little thin in the middle. They're a little long on the ends. The color is not as good. And I'd like to spend, you know, the next couple of years, I guess, trying to get them back. But I know other than pruning them in the spring, I'm not quite sure what else to do in terms of pruning them and shaping them to get them back to healthy again.
You're going to be really happy, man.
Okay.
This is going to be really easy to fix.
Oh, good.
Now, they still do flower for you, right?
Yes, for about 3 weeks every May.
Okay, good, good, good. So what you want to do, as soon as the weather warms up in the spring, is you want to go out and get one of those big, big bricks, blocks, packages of milled peat moss. You've seen these at garden centers, right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And you want to bring that home, and then if you've got any, like, debris, any plant trash underneath the azaleas, old leaves and anything like that,
mm-hmm.
I do a good raking and just clear out underneath the plants. But be careful. Don't get too close to the plants and don't get too rough, because azaleas are very shallow rooted and they have very sensitive roots. They're going to enjoy being cleaned up, but they don't want to be manhandled. So try to have a gentle hand.
Okay.
Then when you get cleaned out underneath them, put down a solid inch of peat moss all underneath every azalea bush. Really go to town. Peat moss is a natural soil acidifier, and azaleas need an acidic soil. So this is going to reacidify their soil in one of the most natural ways possible. And then on top of that inch of peat moss, I want you to put an inch of compost. So those two things, the peat moss is going to send the pH of the soil down lower, which the plants are going to love. I can't tell you, Mike, how quickly the leaf color is going to come back for you. I did this once, and literally overnight, the plants just recovered all of their lost color. It's just amazing what can happen when you give a plant something it's been dying for.
Mm-hmm.
And then the compost will be a nice natural source of nutrition that will serve to feed the plants.
Okay.
After the flowers have faded, That's when you can get in there. That's when you do your pruning and your shaping. Now, don't go nuts. You may want to read up a little bit on azalea pruning in advance so that you kind of have a plan. But obviously, you're going to shape them. With azaleas, I doubt you've seen any signs of true disease. There's no reason to try to open up the center. It sounds like you want to try to fill in the center.
Exactly. I want to fill in the center.
So you're going to be looking to kind of turn branches back around to fill things in.
Right.
And, you know, you're very smart to want to do this over a period of years. And what you can do, you can give them a really good pruning right after the flowers go down. You can remove, because of what I'm going to tell you, I normally would say a third, you can remove 20% of the biomass of the plants after the flowers have faded.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have this wonderful window of opportunity over the next, let's say, 6 weeks after that, where you can go out. And then you can do some more gentle shaping. This is how you really get a plant to look the way you want.
Okay.
And then once we get into like July 1st, mid-June even, I want you to leave them alone because that's when they're going to start setting their buds for the following spring. You're going to love the color of the plants. You're going to love the vigor.
Yeah.
Because of the peat moss in the compost, they're going to respond to the pruning with very vigorous growth. And then if you want to go for the gold, you can repeat that mulching the following year. You can do that every second year or every third year. But follow that pruning rule. Do most of the pruning right after the flowers fade. Then you can shape them for like the next 5-6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have a magnificent display again.
Okay. Thank you very much. I look forward to seeing these next July.
I think you're going to be really happy.
Great. Thank you so much.
Good luck, Mike.
Thanks. Bye-bye now.
1-888-346-9499. Barbara, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Barbara. Where are you?
I'm in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania.
Very good. What can we do for Barb in King of Prussia?
I called about my fig tree. It's about 3 years old. It was 3 feet when I got it. Now it's about 6 feet. But the problem is, I noticed that it had little holes in the ripened figs, and when I opened it up, there was a little white worm in there.
Oh, that's terrible.
It looks like a little thread.
Now,
but it was wiggling.
It's like the old line about the apples. You just eat around the worms.
Yes. Yeah. All right. We'll try that next time.
Okay, so you have a fig tree in Pennsylvania. Do you give it winter protection, or is it in a
shell? Yeah, it gets wrapped for the winter.
And in the spring, do you prune it?
Prune it, yes.
You protect it over winter. You prune it in the early spring. Is it fed or mulched with anything?
I fed it in the spring, and I didn't mulch it with anything.
Good.
Except the grass grows up to about a foot away from the stem of the
tree. That's not the worst
thing
that could happen. Now, what are you feeding it with, though?
I gave it dried cow manure.
Oh, that's interesting. That shouldn't. I think that's totally unnecessary.
Okay.
I've really not heard of people feeding their figs. They're kind of like raspberries, and that
they are.
they tend to do really well when they get no nutrition. The first thing we're going to do is you're not going to feed your fig next year. I don't think it needs it. Now, I haven't really heard about a pest caterpillar infecting figs before, but of course, anything like this is going to have its own pest. Have you noticed when the little holes show up?
It shows up when they're ripened. They're not in the green figs.
Good.
It shows up when they're brown.
Okay, good. You have two choices here, both of which are going to involve you spraying the tree with something, both of which are totally natural. I would go out and I would personally get a bottle of BT, the letter B, the letter T, sold under brand names like Dipel, D-I-P-E-L, Thoracide. Gardens Alive sells it as Green Step. It's one of the oldest organic insecticides. And what it does is it only harms caterpillars who eat sprayed plant parts. So what's happening is a moth is flying in there at some point, probably in the night, laying its eggs on the figs. The eggs are probably so small you can't see them. But then when the eggs hatch and the caterpillars come out, they tunnel into the figs, both to eat the fig and to hide. So if you have sprayed the figs with BT, the caterpillars will die as soon as they try to eat their way into the figs. A bird could grab that caterpillar and eat it. The bird would not be harmed. You will not be harmed during the spraying of the BT or the eating of the figs. It's remarkable. It only affects caterpillars who chew on the sprayed leaves. The other organic pest control is Surround. It's a micronized clay spray that people like myself who grow fruit trees really rely on. At the proper point in the season, you put this clay into water. You buy it as a powder. You mix it with water. You put it in a sprayer. You spray it all over your plants. And it forms a very thin film that does not affect the fruiting of the plants. It actually improves the quality and size of the fruit somehow through a mechanism I don't understand. But it prevents insects from laying eggs or even walking on the plants. They just don't like it. It keeps disease at bay. It keeps all kind of insects at bay. So I think you should be prepared because it sounds like you're due for your first big crop of figs, and both of these things are very safe and inexpensive, so I'd be ready with either BT or Surround.
Oh, good. Okay.
All right?
All right. That sounds great.
Good luck,
Barb. We'll try it. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind listeners in cold climes who heeded my advice to plant pansies outdoors for winter color that now is the time to scavenge, salvage, and otherwise save the branches from discarded cut Christmas trees to use as winter protection for those pansies. Just lay the springy boughs on top of your flowers before an ice or snow event and then uncover them after the event is over. But don't go tearing up unattended Tannenbaums just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and your organic New Year's resolutions. I'm Resolute Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers over 80 new varieties for the 2013 growing season, including Super Sauce, a 2-pound sauce tomato, and On Deck, a sweet corn you can grow in a container. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a few minutes, we'll get to our special feature, not a question of the week, but in the mood of the season, your organic New Year's resolutions. They're coming up after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Al, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike, and thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Al. Where are you, sir?
Well, I'm here in Chad's Ford and just about 30 minutes from Philadelphia in lovely wooded area.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Al in Chad's Ford, Pennsylvania?
Well, I'm a member of the American Chestnut Foundation, and I hadn't heard anything on your show or anyone in the radio business on about our foundation and about what we're doing with the American Chestnut Tree.
You know, Al, I am guilty as charged. I know about the work being done to try to breed a disease-resistant chestnut to bring the American Chestnut Tree back to the Americas. On one of my trips around the country, and I apologize, I don't even remember where I was speaking, but they took me out to visit one of the farms where they're raising some of these trees. And I know it's very important work. Well, bring us up to date, man. Tell us where we are. Do we have a tree?
Well, we have a tree. We're not finished. It's going to take years yet and more interbreeding and so forth. But you must have been down maybe near Meadowview, Virginia, maybe near Roanoke, where we have our basic, our huge farm with plenty of chestnut trees and plenty of cross-pollination going on.
Yes. Now, let's drop back a second. What happened to the American chestnut, one of the most magnificent trees that existed on the continent?
Yes, and it was a tall tree as opposed to the chestnut trees that we have for chestnuts that we sell in the store or so forth, which are Chinese, Japanese, or European, and which have an orchard shape. The American chestnut was a forest tree mainly used for lumber, and of course with a beautiful crop or bounteous crop of chestnuts every year, which fed squirrels, deer, rabbits, you name it, they ate from it, turkeys.
What about humans?
And humans especially, yeah. And in the beginning of the settlements in this country, the Scotch and Irish came over here, and all the tide lands were taken up pretty well and very expensive. So they moved up into the mountains, and everybody wondered how they made a living in the mountains. Well, they made a living basically off the chestnut trees. Chestnuts, as opposed to oaks or any other tree, have a crop every year, and it's a bounteous crop. And so they ate the chestnuts. They let their pigs run loose and their chickens and everything else that ate in the chestnuts. They harvested the wood for their cabins, for their fences, for their shingles. They had chestnut cradles and chestnut coffins.
But what happened to it?
Well, around 1904, they first noticed this blight around the Bronx Zoo. By 1940, this blight had spread all the way to Maine, all the way to Florida, and it had wiped out one quarter of all the hardwoods in the Appalachian chain, which is the American chestnut. It was a huge decimation of the trees. Anyway, the trees themselves die with the blight. And by the way, the blight was brought over here with the Chinese chestnuts. The blight itself is spread through air, by birds, by humans. It's just universal. You can't get away from it. Anyway, the trees themselves would die, but it never killed the roots. So all these chestnut trees would be putting up shoots every year, and the shoots would grow until the blight got them. They'd drop, die off, and then more shoots would start. Having that, we were able to take the American chestnut and start what they call a back-crossing method, which is crossing the American with a Chinese. Then the second cross would be the product of that cross with another American. Then the product of that cross with another American six times until we have a tree that is 95% an American tree, but it has the blight resistance from the Chinese.
What a great idea. This, you know, I've heard about a lot of agricultural research. This seems to be a fairly unique method.
Well, it is and it isn't. It's actually part of the Mendelian theory. And Mendel himself put forth this method of backcrossing. And it's been used in many other crops that we use. But for some reason or other, the Department of Agriculture never got around to trying the back cross method. And so, you know, the blight, they tried to stop it by clear cutting chestnuts all the way across the state of Pennsylvania. That didn't stop it. And then they tried to have protected areas where they could grow it, and the blight came right in wherever it was.
So are you saying that all the work being done to restore the tree now is being done in the private sector?
It is. It's the American Chestnut Foundation, and our website is theamericanchestnutfoundation.org, and it gives a pretty good description of what we're doing. We have some 200,000 trees planted in various stages of cross, and right here in Pennsylvania, we have 50,000 or so trees planted.
Keep up the good work, and people who want to learn more about this, the name of the foundation again?
It's theamericanchestnutfoundation.org.
Okay, very good, Al. Thank you for bringing me up to date. I'm going to try to pay more attention to this in the future.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you. 1-888-346-9499. Kate, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks.
Well, thank you, Kate. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I am just ducky, thanks. Where is Kate well?
In Petoskey, Michigan. We're the northern end of the Lower Peninsula.
You're used to explaining where Petoskey is,
yeah.
Aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What can we do for Kate up in the nether regions?
Well, my question is about using galvanized steel for raised beds.
Huh.
And the reason that I'm considering doing this is I have a friend who had an issue with termites and carpenter ants, and she was told that it's better not to use wood for soil contact landscaping. So I was looking for things to use in its place, and I saw these, they're campfire rings for sale at my local hardware store made out of galvanized steel, and I thought that might be a possibility, but I didn't know if it was safe to use galvanized steel growing food.
How big are they?
Well, they come in a variety of sizes. I'd say they start at about like a 3-foot diameter and maybe go up to like an 8-foot diameter, which would be a little big, I would think, if you couldn't reach across them.
Right. J.I. Rodell, when he was first researching his efforts into organic gardening because he wanted to report his progress to the USDA, he actually had somebody pour concrete circles that were exactly 1/1,000th of an acre in size so that he felt it could be extrapolated. And it's been a long time since I've been there to the old family homestead, but back in the 90s when I was the editor of Organic Gardening, those concrete circles were still there. That is one big alternative. Now, especially where you are up north, the fear of termites, I think, is a little foolish. I've had different kinds of wood in my raised beds over the years, and sometimes it's rotted away and sometimes it's fallen apart, but it's never actually attracted termites. That's really not the way termites work. And carpenter ants only come to wood that is already damaged. So I guess your fear is you're going to bring termites near your house and then they're going to act like cartoon animals. They're going to go, look over there, all that framing, let's go get that.
Roughly, yes.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't work that way. You have termites in your yard right now. Everybody does. And what happens is they just forage around. They stay where the soil is damp. That's what termites want. And the way to keep them out of your house is simply to keep an open area all around your foundation. Don't put any kind of mulch or any kind of cover or do anything that would allow the soil next to the house to stay damp. And termites can't come near you. And if carpenter ants show up in your house, they're doing you a mitzvah because they're telling you you have wood that is damaged, that needs to be repaired, that's rotting away. So to get back to your original question, I have never really seen raised beds made out of metal. And I wonder if that's not for a good reason. Now, we might hear from people who have done it after this. My raised beds are framed with regular old wood, not treated wood. Some of those beams have been out there for 10 years. They're still fine. I also used a lot of field stone, a lot of natural stone. As I was building my garden, all these rocks came up, and I turned them on their side. And I'm going to recommend that you lean towards stone. If you want to have a beautiful raised bed garden,
that would be the most beautiful.
The reason I would advocate you to go for field stone or pavers or some other form of stone is your cold climate. Stone heats up during the day and radiates the warmth back into raised beds in the evening.
Right.
Building your raised bed frames out of stone actually gives you quite a few degrees to play with, to keep your soil warmer, which is hugely important in getting garlic, you know, to grow up early in the spring, to get those spring plantings of peas in there, to get your lettuce and spinach seeds to germinate rapidly. And you can really warm the soil by having the raised bed sides made out of stone. They really do absorb a tremendous amount of heat from direct sunlight and then radiate it back at night. But as you get to the colder climates, stone becomes the framing of choice.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that aspect of it.
That's why I get the big money.
Yeah.
All right, Kate?
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Good luck and stay warm.
We'll do our best.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, as promised, it's time not for the question of the week, but in the spirit of the season, we're going to make some organic New Year's resolutions. Now, to be toxic or not to be? That is the question, gardeners and homeowners. And let me assure those of you not yet converted that it isn't a hard question. There is nothing noble about suffering the slings and arrows of outrageous nerve toxins and hormonal disruptors. As many of you heard on the show earlier this month, the American Academy of Pediatrics has just issued a strong position paper on the dangers posed to children by pesticide use, even when it's, quote, just the parents of those children using pesticides outdoors on the lawn and in the garden. The dangers of spraying toxins indoors should be self-evident. And in mid-November, a new study from the University of California added to the massive body of literature linking pesticide use to an increased risk of Parkinson's. Now, the good news is that all these implicated interventions are 100% unnecessary. You don't need indoor or perimeter sprays to have a pest-free house. You don't need insecticides, fungicides, or herbicides to have a nice green lawn or great garden. In fact, 14 years of listener emails has clearly shown me that people who spray have more plant and pest problems than people who don't. So, along with your resolutions to get more exercise, eat healthier food, and stop flipping the bird to people who have just cut you off in traffic, I'd like those of you who are still spraying for pests indoors, having your lawn treated with toxins and or using poisons in your potager, to commit to a new beginning. A new year in which you'll protect your health and have your best garden and most pest-free home ever. Now raise your right hand, your other right hand, and repeat these resolutions after me. I will get my plants off drugs. No more attacking the environment and yourself with caustic chemical fertilizers, hormonally harmful herbicides, or poisonous pesticides. Instead, I will use compost. So-called conventional fertilizers contain harsh chemical salts whose original use was the manufacture of high explosives. Isn't that fun? They weaken your plants by forcing them to grow faster than nature ever intended, which makes those poor steroid pump plants much more attractive to pests and disease. Instead, feed your garden the way nature feeds the forest, with compost made from shredded leaves or worm castings, a sensational fertilizer you can make from your own kitchen waste, and a bin and some worms, of course. 2 inches of compost or castings provides all the food any plant needs for a year, and it makes your landscape naturally resistant to pests and disease. I will water correctly. Frequent short sprinkles result in weak, shallow-rooted plants. Your lawn and garden will grow strong with long, deep, infrequent soakings. If nature provides an inch of water in any given week, sit on your hose. Otherwise, deliver that essential inch in 1 or 2 long sessions, ending just as the sun is rising. Never water in a way that lets your lawn or garden stay wet overnight. And never water every day. Your plant's roots need to dry out between waterings. I will mulch. Applying a 1 to 2 inch layer of shredded leaves, pine straw, or compost around your plants will help retain soil moisture and prevent weeds. Don't use disease-breeding, plant-food-stealing wood, root, or bark mulches. They're worse than no mulch at all. And never let any mulch actually touch a plant. I will treat my grass like a living plant. People cut all the green growth off their lawn, complain about how bad it looks, and then pour chemicals on top. Instead, adjust your mower to allow the grass to attain its natural height, and it will thrive. That's 2 to 2.5 inches for warm season grasses down south, 3 inches for cool season grasses up north. A correct cut allows your grass to grow the deep roots that crowd out even the worst weeds. A lawn that's correctly cut also looks greener and fuller. And correctly cut lawns grow slower than scalped ones, which means you'll do much less cutting. I will mulch my clippings back into the lawn. Fresh grass clippings are 10% nitrogen by weight. Nitrogen is a lawn's favorite food. Sense a pattern here? Use a dedicated mulching mower to return the pulverized clippings to your turf, and you'll supply half of the food your lawn needs in any given year, and you won't have to deal with any clippings. I will not panic when I see a bug. Only a very small percentage of insects are pests, so don't go killing everything you see, especially indoors where you and your family are sure to inhale more of what you're spraying than any potential pests. True indoor pest problems are always best controlled with traps or other non-toxic tactics. Just look up the name of the pest in our A to Z answer section before you spray. And finally, resolve to have fun. Don't lose sight of why we grow. Nature is beautiful and relaxing. We try and capture the spirit of nature when we garden. Your sanctuary of solace is no place for poisons. Well, those sure were some good resolutions to, well, resolve to, now, wasn't they? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website, where you can read it over at your leisure. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to unmulch my mower if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Put the actual subject in the subject line and check voiced to see if the information you seek is already waiting at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section. Watch the video of my recent TEDx talk and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and of course, like us on Facebook. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's Internet Illuminati. Special thanks to Sarah Donner for coming in to sing Overrated New Year. You'll find the link to the video of that song at our website. Larry Roebling continues to shine as our substitute producer, while Alexis Landis, who normally produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, continues caring for the official cute baby of You Bet Your Garden, Ari Landis. Our social media director is radiantly resplendent Amanda McGrath. Our production assistant is brightly burnished Brett Rader. Our esteemed editor is beaming Al Banks. I'm your dim bulb, Mike McGrath, and I'll try and light up just enough to see you again next week. A rose is a rose, but is a pear a pear? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll delve into the difference between pears that fruit and those that just flower. Plus your fabulous phone calls.